There's different sections for the subcommittees. So we can save files here for, the rural subcommittee, but also we created a place in the main task force folder for energy action worksheets, which is an agenda item we'll be talking about later on this meeting. And hopefully we're reserving the majority of that meeting kind of talking about actions that the subcommittee wants to take. But if you click that link, it's going to take you to an Excel file. This Excel file can be opened up in the browser or through Microsoft Excel. Let us know if you have trouble accessing the SharePoint site. We can get you set up. It is going to be a way that we're going to be sharing information with all the subcommittees. And I'll hit this Excel spreadsheet in detail later, but I just want to give you a sneak peek. This Excel spreadsheet has tabs for each of the subcommittees, so everyone will be able to see actions across the board. For rural, the main focus is going to be just updating six dark blue columns for this meeting, and then we'll kind of fill in details later. But think of this as more of kind of a brainstorming exercise. And as we go through this, you can decide to continue looking at actions or withdraw them. And all of that's going to culminate, too, at the end process in kind of scenarios that of the different ways that the actions can be pulled together, modified, whether it's through timing, funding, and that's where Black and Beach will be supporting the subcommittee. The overall kind of time frame and goals, it would be great for the next task force meeting to have a high-level outline of kind of your top preferred strategies or actions that this subcommittee wants to explore, so that when we start meeting as a complete task force, all the different subcommittees will have their, priority actions that they're interested in pursuing. And as this evolves, we'll flesh them out. So think about this. I encourage this meeting to be more of a kind of the brainstorming meeting, and kind of also just a meeting where we focus on the top priority areas that we're trying to accomplish. So that's kind of where we're going with the milestones. I also have an item here, preferred name for report section. Andrew, I know you, at the task force meeting, you gave kind of a preference for that. That would be consistent with the rail belt. So we can definitely reserve time to talk about that, but it might be good to kind of focus on the actions, and that name and the kind of the report is going to evolve. And we can at a future task force meeting, if we want to do a Mentimeter live poll or polling as a subcommittee, we can test out different names for the section. Just wanted to pause there if there's any questions and any comments from the chairs or the members.
So the main concern or way forward for me is, I agree with you, we need to take action, and it has to begin now. You know, we've been meeting since April, and I told Clay earlier that we haven't even made the first step yet. Mm-hmm. So we've wasted a lot of time already. You know, we didn't have really good leadership, I think, in terms of how this task force was structured. The way it's structured now is kind of making silos of different areas of the state, and that's why I made a big deal about the name. You know, if we're going to have a name for each region, they should have the same title. Some areas of the state have gotten a lot of money put into their infrastructure, energy infrastructure, while other areas of the state have not yet. And that's why we have such a huge disparity. And we need to rectify that. And we do that by acting. So I think the biggest strategy that we need to kind of agree on is make rural the same as the rail belt, southeast. You know, all of the areas in the state have potential, and they can add to any grid that's put in place. you know, just can't be coming from the rail belt area. You know, so, it's rural, whether it's in the east or the west, can add a lot to the energy situation that we have in the state. And that will, you know, like I presented back the action plan I presented to the committee, you know, if we follow some of the action plans, we'll get to the same stage where 10 cents a kilowatt hour, plus or minus a few cents, you know, for every area of the state.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, to that point, I can give a sneak preview that survey that we sent out on the kind of the keywords for the goals. Right now, I think we've had 9 responses so far. I think a reminder email just was sent out. You know, please respond if you haven't. But the overall, just from those 9 responses, the kind of the top 3 keywords that are trending from the, you know, the overall goals are, you know, affordability, reliability, and then a leave no one behind approach. So that kind of speaks to, you know, energy equity and affordability. So hopefully that's in line too with the approach for rural. But having said that, I just wanted to invite, you know, Clay or any other members to kind of react to what Andrew said. And the other thing I will say, I'm happy to bring back this action worksheet. We definitely want to see this starting, you know, start fill this out. Even if we want to treat this committee meeting as kind of a brainstorming exercise of what actions do we want to pursue, even if we don't, if we need more data, more research, we can start populating this. And I have my colleagues, you know, Karin and Mark, they're going to be in this behind the scenes, and we can populate real time just as you're discussing. And we can start just listing things here, and we'll finalize it for the next task force meeting, what we actually want to present. But we can use this as a space to just kind of brainstorm.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd appreciate it if you can keep that in the background so that we can kind of see each other on the big screen and just populate it. So, I agree with Andrew. I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about structure. And we'd like to get into some meat with this meeting, which is agenda item 3, which is actually identifying strategies and actions. And I'll facilitate that section of it if you don't mind, Andrew. But I just wanted to agree with Andrew that, you know, a unifying vision is important. And that's really what we need is where do we want Alaska to be? We want to have affordable energy. We want to have healthy economies and healthy communities. And so in that regard, each subcommittee, each region should be striving for the same goals, while they may have different resources, opportunities, and challenges. Before we dig in, though, we kind of skipped through introductions and whatnot. I know a lot of us are in this space and know each other. Is there any objection to just starting a kind of a SWOT process where we start looking at rural strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and start building those up into strategies? Okay, then strategies and actions, a lot of us have touched, yeah.
Wait, sorry to interrupt. It looks like there was a call-in number that just joined us.
I'm sorry, the name again?
I'm sorry, someone just called in. Can you repeat your name?
Dan Graham.
What's your representation, Dan?
I'm general manager for Donlin Gold.
Okay. So it's a committee meeting. I don't think there's any objections to listening in. If you do have a question, you can raise your hand, and if we have the time and don't have other committee input, we can recognize you. But thank you for joining.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just starting to say there's a lot of deep experience at the table here. I just texted a couple of our other colleagues, and they have conflicts and can't call in Aaron and Nils. But do we want to, does anyone want to start by maybe listing some of the just global issues or characteristics of rural Alaska and strategies that we might develop, general strategies at least, to move towards affordable energy in rural Alaska? I guess I'll start just to get the ball rolling. One of the biggest challenges in rural Alaska is economies of scale. The number one driver of electric utility rates is how many meters are connected to the system. We're still largely a central power economy of scale type industry, and there's a legacy graph that once you start dropping below 100,000 meters in a system, the price starts rising, and once you get below 10,000 meters, it starts rising exponentially. You're just spreading too many operational costs across too few meters. So that's a challenge, and so there's some strategies that can be taken to help manage that. You can try to build a bigger economy of scale. That's part of the reason that communities connect each other with transmission lines. I'll just stop there, and maybe we can think about different ways that we could tackle economy of scale, which is one of the biggest challenges in rural energy. Or you can add new ones like transportation, logistics, so forth.
Well, one of the things to consider is that if when you're talking about economy of scale, is that the potential out there. You know, in rural Alaska, there is a lot of ice lands, and even state lands. There's a lot of state land out there with potential. And some of those resources, you know, are known. A lot of it is unknown. But I do know of resources that will never be developed if there isn't an affordable energy available, just because they're just not big enough, you know. So the question becomes the chicken or the egg when you talk about economy of scale. When you provide that low-cost energy, you know, other things will start coming on, and that'll provide the economy of scale at a later point in time, you know. Right now, we know with the populations of the villages and how spread out they are, yeah, we have it. But then we're not even considering the resources that can be developed out there, whether on state or private land.
That's a good point, Andrew. And let's call that an anchor tenant. So if you have a large industrial load or industrial base potential, and you can bring in that large load, it isn't necessarily about trying to expand your load from 1,000 residents to 1,500 residents. Here in Cordova, we have a seafood processing industrial base that not only helps pay for building hydropower, but also made their business more competitive. So those opportunities are out there in rural Alaska.
And just a quick, you know, aside as well, in talking with the other subcommittee meetings, we've had one meeting so far with the Statutes and Regulations Subcommittee. One thing that came up, especially as it relates to rural, is with all the federal grants coming online, you know, the local cost share, there's a hurdle for local, you know, rural communities. So one of the recommendations from APA was legislation that, you know, created a state match to help offset those burdens.
I see there's some chat things coming in, so let's...
I see Andrew Jensen is in the waiting room. I'm just allowing him in.
Okay. So, other...
Before we really get into the strategies, we need the information too. Can Michael Baker and Black and Beach do some data mining about what may be out there?
So we just had a request to kind of get kind of baseline data. We're working with AEA and the data subcommittee. We know that they're going to be meeting a little later, so that data is coming. And then we're pulling some existing resources from, you know, existing plans in the state, but then also plans from outside the state. So we're happy to compile that. But specifically, do you have any specific requests that you're looking for?
Well, I do know about current hydropower, like in the Bristol Bay area, and potential hydro toward the Waikane Delta, and the other areas of the state have different kind of potential too. So it's those that I'm thinking of, and whether or not you with Black and Reach can start doing some modeling on those kind of potentials.
Go ahead, Michael. Well, I was just going to invite, I believe the modeling will occur after we kind of have all the actions, but I mean, we can certainly look at baseline data, especially the work that's being done on the data, you know, subcommittee.
I'm just saying that I think after we look at the baseline data, from a Black Lead perspective, what we can help is to really maybe identify some potential resources that could be useful in terms of meeting demand of people who are really very, very kind of scattered around, doesn't have a density that's really essential to kind of like a successful large-scale utility company. So we can propose some of the technologies from that perspective. And but I think what we would like to say is that we really are not familiar with kind of like what's currently being deployed and what has been studied in the rural area of Alaska. But I think we can actually definitely give you some idea as to generally from our perspective based on the type of demand or type of demand that we need to meet, what are could be the potential technologies for you to consider.
Okay, thank you. Let's do this. I'm going to ask everyone to raise their hand to be acknowledged, including Michael Baker and Black and Beach. We've only got an hour here, and we're I want to get through this agenda and make some progress. So Jason Brune.
Yep, thank you. I just wanted to follow up on what Andrew said. Andrew, obviously, I think it's a great idea, but when you mentioned hydro in Bristol Bay or, you know, long time ago, like 10, 15 years ago, Shell was out there exploring. There was natural gas potential out in the North Aleutian Basin. There's a lot of NIMBYism to these type of opportunities, and they don't, they're local people, they want low-cost power, but they don't want hydro to potentially impact the salmon streams or the North Aleutian Basin natural gas project that Shell was interested in had the huge potential to bring in low-cost power to your region, Andrew, and to both the Chulista region and the Bristol Bay region. And so those are potentials that are there, but you have to make sure that you're identifying the hurdles that that folks will want their cake and eat it too. They'll want to oppose those type of projects, but they'll also want the low-cost power. So that's where there's such an unfortunate dichotomy that we've seen in the last many instances. Thank you.
So, Michael, can you capture that as one of the challenges is local opposition to energy opportunities? And we might even say hydro and natural gas.
I would even add what we just came out with yesterday is microreactors. The rank package just got finalized yesterday and signed by the lieutenant governor. There's a press release coming out that, in fact, I'm working on. That has a huge opportunity to decarbonize rural Alaska, but at the same time, you know there will be opposition to that as well. So, yes, thank you. Sorry for interrupting there.
No, that's perfect. And we can certainly capture that if my colleagues, Mark and Karin, you know, definitely record that. But I also challenge us that once we identify these challenges, let's think about the kind of the opportunities to help offset that. So what, you know, what could possibly help with that? Is it, you know, capability or capacity building with the local community? Is it outreach and engagement, informing them of the benefits? There could be potential grant programs to help fund that, especially, you know, as you're looking to for infrastructure funding for these. You know, there could be management dollars from federal agencies, the state agencies could kind of go out and have these programs. So I just wanted to throw that out there to help kind of think about actions and policies that can help rural communities.
Well, let's do that. Once we get some things mapped, then we can say, okay, for these problems, how do we manage those? For these solutions, how do we develop them? I'm just going to add in response to Andrew as well. Something that was done about 10 years ago by the Alaska Energy Authority was an energy, statewide energy atlas. And they went through every community and region and identified all the known energy resources there. And, the AEA is updating that as part of this whole energy strategy task force. So it'll at least, bring it up to current to what we know are known opportunities. Garrett.
Thanks, Clay. I think first I'd agree with your comment that economies of scale are a huge problem, and that only gets worse, as Andrew knows, in villages when we're talking about these tiny standalone utilities that operate in, you know, one village. I think AVEC's been tremendously helpful in alleviating that. So has AEA. But that leads into the challenge of capacity, right? It's incredibly hard to find people to work in these remote communities and keep things up, which is why we now have approximately $1 billion, give or take. Tim, correct my number if I'm wrong there, in terms of backlog maintenance for powerhouses and bulk fuel farms. And everybody's talking about the amount of money that's out there for grants right now, but that's incredibly hard for people to go after when you are a standalone utility. And even if you get the grant, we've discussed the challenge of finding MASH. And then I'd like to just build quickly on Jason's comment, and you don't need to tell me this, but it's not just NIMBYism, but it's a lot of astroturfing in those regions for outside groups come in, bunch of money and things and some of this. And so dealing with outside groups that come in and tell us what we should be doing is tremendously frustrating. Thank you.
The audio connection was breaking up a little there. Can you, I apologize, it might have been just me, but could you repeat what you just said, the last part?
I was just kind of building on Commissioner Bruni's comments about NIMBYism, and it's not just NIMBYism, it's astroturfing, which is where, you know, outside environmental groups will come in and dump a bunch of money into a campaign opposing a project development that may not be organic.
Okay. So I heard another big challenge in rural development is capacity. And I think you mentioned human capacity, but I think we could expand that to financial capacity as well. Small communities have small resource pools in terms of human resources, but often don't have good capitalization either. Other challenges in rural energy. I think you kind of touched on it, Garrett, but it's logistics is huge. In different regions of the state, it's different challenges, but most rural communities are limited to either an airport or a port, sometimes both, and very often seasonal and very weather impacted. So whether it's transportation or shipping or just even physically having large enough equipment and infrastructure to move larger devices and equipment gets very challenging. So logistics is a key barrier or a contributor to cost of energy.
Just to add on that, one item that kind of came up under the other kind of subcommittee too was the discussion of the supply chain disruptions and how, you know, it might be good to talk about how rural communities may be impacted by that.
I think supply chain is always challenging, and depending on how rural a community is, and maybe just more challenging now.
Just to put it in context of what we were talking about earlier, it came up too when we were talking about if you're going after grants, sometimes the period of performance of the grant ends and then you don't, there was a supply chain disruption, it was hard to get the equipment. Sometimes that can be avoided through extensions, other times the grant program, it's hard to get the extension.
Can we maybe toggle to the list we have so far?
So, Mark, do you have that? Or I do have the action worksheet, but I don't see it updated.
Okay. Sorry to put you on the spot. Sometimes if you have your working list to work from, it can spur some thoughts.
My apologies. I thought I was recording action items and not just challenges, but I'm happy to start putting those in if you'd like the challenges listed in here as well.
Just a separate document just to help with this discussion.
Okay, so we can kind of roll to that. What are potential solutions to some of these? So in economy of scale, one potential solution is ways to grow economies of scale are connecting communities by transmission. Another way is to attract anchor tenants. Jason.
You just hit the nail on the head. Anchor tenants, and you mentioned that earlier as well. I mean, large resource development projects, fish processing plants, mines, oil and gas operations. Those are going to lead to a baseload power that is going to allow for inexpensive power pipelines, you name it, that will help help bring the cost of power down. And many of those companies that are wanting to bring those resource development projects to rural Alaska are more than happy to help local communities benefit as well. So and other industries as well. So I know that when Evelyn Donlin were being contemplated bringing in natural gas or other such energy sources could help those mines come to fruition, but could also help bring cheaper power for the fishing industry for ice production or for the fish processing opportunities. So there's lots of that that has been discussed, but then, you know, again, going back to the discussion that occurred before, you know, that would require that those two projects would actually occur. And there's opposition to both of those. But anchor tenants for sure, there's opportunities for that for, and especially in the areas, I would say the areas of the state, Southwest Alaska, that has some of the most expensive power and has the most need for that that economic diversification that could bring in that lower cost power.
Well, Jason, I think you're hitting on something that managers of rural utilities or stakeholders in rural communities have to confront on a daily basis, and that is thinking holistically. So you can't just look at a project in isolation and say all the benefits and all the costs revolve just around that project. If you're building a road to the project, if you're building energy infrastructure, if it has a medical facility to support the development that can also support the community, there's a whole smorgasbord of benefits and costs, and that's an opportunity to look at those and design those in on the front end so that you maximize the not only the benefits but the stakeholders who benefit from those benefits. And I'm just going to throw out economies of scope. In rural Alaska, this happens very often where you may have several utilities and one of them digs a trench and the utilities all share facilities in that trench, whether it's gas or water lines or sewer lines or phone, electric cable. So you may have what appears like completely different businesses, but they find ways to share costs and share benefits and develop economies of scope. And you might also have a utility that provides both water and heat and electricity, for example. So when there's similarities in their business platform, instead of having three or four or five different organizations, you can kind of combine a lot of your services under into one group and develop an economy of scope to help manage the cost around economy of scale. Logistics. Well, local opposition. Jason, you've worked in this public arena a lot. Others, how do you confront local opposition?
If I knew that, I wouldn't be in the job that I'm currently in.
The biggest project we ever done here, the Trans-Alaskan pipeline, TAPS. You know, I was a kid back then, I do remember the opposition. They were saying TAPS stood for a Port of Polluted State, you know. But look at the history, you know, with the NEPA process, the modern technology put into it. You know, we can point to this Trans-Alaska pipeline as a model project, you know, to offset the local opposition to future projects. And you have the Red Dog Mine that went through the NEPA process, and we have so many examples of environmentally safe projects, big projects that have been completed, you know.
So,
I'd say your point's well said. I mean, there are legitimate concerns that stakeholders have, and it's important to recognize them and to do your best to try to mitigate those potential impacts. Obviously, when the first project, major project in the United States that went through the NEPA process was the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, and there were significant concerns about a potential oil spill happening in Prince William Sound. Well, lo and behold, fast forward to 1989, that occurred. Well, we know a lot more now than we did then. We have double hull tankers. We have ship escort systems. We have regular trainings and drills that occur. Those are things that we should have anticipated in advance. And so it's important. And so in answer, to your question, Clay, I think engage with stakeholders early, often, understand their concerns, mitigate those impacts, do your best to do away with fear-mongering, recognize that everything we use in our life needs energy, needs natural resource extraction. If we don't do it here, it's going to be done elsewhere around the world where the environmental ethic isn't the same as it is here. And, you know, as long as we don't have those anchor tenants like you mentioned, we're going to be paying 50, 70, 90 cent power. We're going to be having diesel in rural Alaska. We're not going to have the opportunities to maintain schools staying open in rural Alaska because the cost is so expensive, and subsequently the cultures will be maintained. The two places where you see cultures thriving in this state are on the North Slope in Northwest Alaska, where the Red Dog Mine and oil and gas development occurs, and we have more opportunities for that in the state, and I think we should be really making sure, Clay, like you said, understand the concerns people have and try to give them that confidence that by potentially bringing those projects in, we can bring the cost of electricity down to that 10-cent goal that the governor has, that we could allow folks to keep the schools open and stay in the villages and maintain the subsistence ways of life. There's so many positive benefits to that. So I think the quick answer I give to your question, Clay.
Okay. Let's capture Andrew's too, which is examples or case studies of successful case studies, and even failures can be used as a case study, like Prince William Sound case. You know, in the rearview mirror, does that mean we never should have built the oil pipeline and the ballast? So if bad things do happen, is that the reason that you shouldn't do something, because bad things can happen? So one we've had experience developing a hydro where there was, I guess, AstroTurf opposition, local groups attracting outside stakeholders to oppose the hydro development. And what I found is that what was really successful was visual education, one, and that this is part of what the early and frequent engagement with stakeholders is. But I think it's worth saying education separately, and especially visuals, because people are so visual. And for a hydro project, if you can actually show what the visual water fluctuation in the watershed is, for example, an inundation area, or you show what the actual physical footprint of a modular nuclear facility is, people have can connect with it, and they tend to not build their own pictures, which can be much more frightening, I guess. Other mitigations for local opposition or opposition to energy opportunities. What about logistics? That would be transportation, supply chain, as you mentioned, Michael. Human resources, again, could be an issue. Well, weather, certainly, of course, just the environmental conditions.
What about reliability as well? Just continuity of operations, backups?
Sorry, when you say human resources, do you mean like work availability of workforce?
Yeah, also workforce that understands and works in the rural environment where, you know, if you forget a tool or if you forget some spare parts, you might set yourself back several weeks or months.
You know, my thought on logistics is that in Jalista, we own a construction company, and we have a lot of projects in rural Alaska, and logistics is a big part of just doing business, you know. So it can be managed, especially by those companies that are expert in rural projects. So it's manageable. And we do have companies operating in rural Alaska that can handle all of these issues and manage them.
That's a really good point, Andrew. And that's why, Michael, when you mentioned the supply chain issues, global supply chain issues right now, I would guess Alaska is one of the least impacted places because we have such ferocious logistics challenges anyway. We're just like, oh. You know, another issue. Maybe things don't get here quite as quickly, but we're used to managing those, and that's actually one of our key strengths is managing those logistics. So transportation, we could obviously develop new roads, and I would say innovation offers some opportunities there. Electric aviation, for example, maybe slower flying planes that can fly in different environments. There's an opportunity for emerging technologies to maybe create some opportunities we haven't had before.
Maybe we can add fiber optics in this. You know, I know of two communities in my region that are interconnected, and the utility line that connects them is buried in the river. And it's been buried in the river for over 30 years, and, you know, it's good. It runs okay. They didn't need to do transmission lines above the ground. Now, with the plan for fiber optics, you know, it's going to be in the river. Is there an opportunity to lay transmission lines and fiber optics, you know, at the same time, you know, trying to share the cost?
Okay. And Clay, to clarify, is that what you mean as well when you say economies of scope is having multiple projects kind of at the same time to offset each other?
Exactly. And there's a bit of innovation there, too, of laying, you know, power lines in rivers isn't something you would normally think of in lower 48 environment.
Is the concept of future-proofing the improvements as well, whether it's fiber optics or broadband, it can create innovation at the same time? These are kind of like the secondary benefits.
Like through the deployment process?
Mm-hmm. Or just having the, as we use technology to kind of leverage improvements, how things are interconnected with sensors and Internet of Things, how you, maintenance and operations of for the energy infrastructure, instead of sending one person out, now you can have sensors connected through broadband. It's more of a challenge in the rural area, but, just where the industry is going overall for infrastructure, those are some of the trends we're seeing.
I just had a funny visual. If you had a drone with like a 40 or 50 mile range, you could almost have a drone fleet set up like a Pony Express to shuttle parts from place to place. But sorry, I just wanted to look at the people, and I saw that Nils Andreessen and others were able to join. So we're just kind of in a SWAT process for those that have joined recently. They're just kind of going through challenges, opportunities, weaknesses, and threats, and mapping out and trying to build those up into strategies, general strategies for rural Alaska.
Thanks, Clay. This is Nils. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Maybe just add to the current conversation. The reason I wasn't on is there was a project bundling discussion that number of state agencies, the governor's office was just holding. So there's definitely this effort around how do we identify transportation, broadband, energy, water, sewer projects in a single community or region, find efficiencies and economy of scale, and deliver those projects in new and different ways. So I think that discussion is timely, and there's probably some follow-up with some of the, I think it was DOT and the governor's office that was leading that conversation, so I'll just throw that out there.
Thanks, Nils. Any potential solutions for the supply chain or just general thoughts on supply chain, weather, reliability? I know, delivering materials and goods and fuel and so forth has logistical challenges that are weather related. But also just operating utilities in rural areas where you don't have transportation and logistical support, weather impacts can be a lot more difficult. I'll just use Cordova as an example. We converted all of our distribution system to underground power lines to mitigate the frequent wind and snowstorms that would tear the lines apart. Other nearby communities would be hit by those same storms and wouldn't have additional resources. So we mitigated by installing our lines underground. Now, ironically, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative is having all kinds of weather-related problems with their underground lines, and they're converting those to overhead, because they're in a different region. But I guess weather mitigations could take a whole bunch of forms, but in general, you want to design infrastructure that's suited to the weather. You have to understand the local weather patterns. We installed a battery energy storage system here in Cordova, and a lot of engineering elements of making sure you turn it into the wind and rain so that it drains off. You put the doors on the downwind side. You don't have vertical vents. You have vents that are horizontal to the ground, so rain can't be forced in. So weather can be mitigated, and a lot of that comes down to engineering and hardening.
If the members don't have a question, I do have a question. So I'll relate that to help potentially drive the discussion, but when you talk about weather reliability, oftentimes it's kind of referred to in terms of natural disasters or FEMA, and often there's funding through that, through some of the FEMA funds. funding program. So I'm just curious, is there local experience with that on a, in for rural communities in Alaska?
I'll answer for myself. In the 25 years I've been here, we've had three different declared disasters where we ended up doing significant hundreds of thousands up to millions of dollars of repair work. FEMA does have mitigation programs as well where they can invest. They're starting more and more to invest on the front end. And, for example, if you build a hydro dam storage project that can help mitigate water supply issues or droughts and floods and so forth, then maybe you can get a FEMA investment, or maybe it can be an emergency water supply for your region. So I don't know if that hits on that.
No, I think it does, and maybe, you know, that when we start talking about case studies too, pointing to those and just future opportunities too, for rural, you know, FEMA could be a potential funding source.
Again, Michael, we've got about 9 minutes left, and I know you probably want to go through and at least I've captured these tasks in your spreadsheet, and I'm happy to share that so that we can maybe clarify that with the subcommittee, just to confirm that what I captured fits what they communicated. And then Karin's been, you know, basically taking notes about you know, potential solutions as well. But I think personally, you know, I think at least getting a start on what are the tasks that this subcommittee wants to tackle, if you will, is a good starting point. So if you don't mind, I'll share my screen, and that way we can take a look at what I captured and see if it's what the committee intended. So the first action I've named is the anchor tenant identity. Well, first of all, Michael, why don't you go ahead and just walk through the sheets real quickly, and I can kind of scroll through it so that the subcommittee understands what the intent of using this is for.
Sure. Just very quickly, you know, these dark blue columns are what we intended to kind of fill in first. There's six columns, and, you know, first one's just the simple description of action name, action description, and the timeline for implementation. Those are, you know, very simple, whether they're immediate, short, medium, or long term. And then the next two columns just describe the, you know, the lead organization that may be involved in implementing it. If there's any partners or collaborators that, you know, would be involved. And then the action status column is simply whether it's a new action that the state or the task force is looking to pursue, whether it's building on an ongoing kind of project, policy, or activity, or, you know, if it's an action that ultimately we talked about but we want to withdraw from the final recommendation. And then the columns in yellow are kind of secondary fields that can be filled in if we have the information now, but if they don't need to be focused on at the moment, but, you know, if there's a estimated cost, possible funding source, if there's more information needed or other barriers to implementation. And then the columns in black are more just administrative tracking, you know, if we're going to assign any of these tasks to anyone, due dates, comments, and if it's completed. So with that, I think, Mark, you just took the first task just to help advance the conversation. And by all means, think of this as a brainstorming session. These can be tweaked, and we'll upload this with approval to the file that's on the SharePoint site.
Mark, community capacity.
Yep, okay. We'll title it that.
And, I mean, workforce development, I've come to resent that word. Everybody talks about it, and it doesn't seem to become actionable.
Let me see here. I was looking at, yeah, so human resources, but also capital capacity, right?
Yeah. And maybe maybe financing is a separate element all its own. Michael's been making the point that there's external opportunities, but yeah, it's really both.
So yeah, I'll try to wordsmith that a little bit more, but I'd like to just clarify with you, you know, what I heard, what I think I heard from this subcommittee on anchor tenant identification. So where are the potential energy anchor tenants that provide economy of scale for rural communities? So, you know, that's a broad, you know, but where are these, right? You know, Donlin Gold is an example that Andrew brings up. But there are, you know, you brought up the fish processing folks there in Cordova. What other communities have these potential anchor tenants? And I think that's a task that you'd like to explore, you know, as far as where are the, you know, where are these large potential anchor tenants around the state, where there are, you know, potential resource development, or other, you know, resources that are already there that just need to be, what's the right term? Developed, I guess. Does that clarify with you what you're looking for?
Yeah, I read through those and they all look good.
Okay. Okay. Andrew, any comments or anybody else in the, from the subcommittee on these that, you know, you want to clarify or, you know, refine the statement that's in there as far as the action description?
I assume that the potential sources of generators will be forthcoming with, so we don't need to list it here now.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and, you know, and I think both you and Clay brought up this idea of transmission across communities, and I think what kind of popped in my mind is, you know, where is it most, where would it be most likely to connect those communities, right? Which communities would we connect? And then where also would your source of energy generation be? You know, in other words, what's the policy around that? How do you define that? And how do you make the best decisions around where the power should be generated and what communities should be connected?
Yeah. You know, one project that we pursued back over 10 years ago was the Tsukumuk Hydropower Project. It got to the first stage, but then died because we couldn't get the state legislature to pass allowing that particular project to happen on a state parkland. And what's interesting about that is this was on a lake that had two other lakes underneath it, and those other two lakes underneath it were eligible for hydropower development, but then at the same time they were salmon spawning, those two, and the one we were pursuing didn't even have salmon spawning in it, but it still wasn't able to pass pass the state legislature, and we even had BLM and the Fish and Wildlife from the Fed side supporting that project. That project would have lit up, connected 13 communities on the at the initial stage anyway, on the lower Keswickum River.
So
the communities are 1 mile apart, 5 mile apart, you know, close together.
Can you send me the name of that, Andrew? And then, you know, because I think it could be a really good example, right, that we could
yeah,
potentially use under the engaging opposition, right? Now, in other words,
think,
you know,
if you can type it, CHIKUMINUK, Tsukumuk Hydropower Project.
CHIKU, that's as far as I got.
CHIKUMINUK. And that's the name of the link.
Just to be mindful, I know we're approaching time, and I wanted to have closing remarks by Clay and Andrew, but feel free, we'll update this spreadsheet, and feel free to make any modifications online. But I'll just turn it over to Clay and Andrew.
That's all I was going to suggest for the last pieces on the agenda. We have the next meeting scheduled for member assignments. I would just suggest that we all try to spend a few minutes on here fleshing this out or adding any gaps. And maybe be prepared to discuss generation resources and distribution options in stuff the next meeting.
I agree.
So did you have a date for that, Clay?
This says August 10th, 1 p.m., Thursday, August 10th. Is that meant to be the next rural meeting?
That's the next meeting for this group, yes.
Okay, yeah.
It's on the calendar. Everybody should have it.
Gotcha. Yes.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, we'll follow up, Clay.
Yeah.
See you in a minute.